Today at Reader's Corner, part two of our interview with Terry Williams, author of The Odyssey of KP2, An Orphan Seal, a Marine Biologist, and The Fight to Save a Species.
And that's how we do all of our science. I want to first know, how deep can they dive? How long do they hold their breath? What water temperatures do they need? And that's what we did with KP2. One of the things that National Marine Fisheries Service is trying to do is to designate what's the critical habitat. Which beach gets to be a human beach? Which beach should be a seal beach? We have to have a change in the way that we deal with endangered species. What is it that they need, and then how do we start to figure out how we're both going to survive on this planet?
I'm Bob Custer, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Today we're continuing an encore presentation of our interview with Terry Williams, author of The Odyssey of KP2, An Orphan Seal, A Marine Biologist, and The Fight to Save a Species. On last week's show, Dr. Williams recounted her initial experiences working with a young Hawaiian monk seal known as KP2, which was transported to her lab at the University of California, Santa Cruz, from its home in Hawaii. On today's program, we'll talk more about KP2, one of only 1,100 Hawaiian monk seals on the planet. In her book, which is now out in paperback, Dr. Williams weaves a fascinating story of what she learned by studying the playful and affectionate KP2 and about her concerns for the future survival of this species. The Odyssey of KP2 is this year's campus read at Boise State. The book was given to all first-year students last summer and has since been discussed in classes as part of efforts to build a shared community. I'm pleased to announce that Dr. Williams will be visiting Boise State this coming week. She will present a lecture open to the public at 6 p.m. on Tuesday, March 3rd in the Simplot Ballroom in the Student Union Building. Check boisestate.edu for more details. Dr. Williams is director of the Marine Mammal Physiology Project at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and a co-creator of the Center for Ocean Health. She joins us from her office at UC Santa Cruz for this interview. Terry Williams, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Terrific being here.
So in order for you to do your research, you have people around you, staff, trainers, who really work on a daily, hourly basis around the clock with these seals. Tell us about the two trainers who are so integral to the book story, and also the first problem they had. How do you convince a seal to eat?
So I have two people that are actually paid staff. It's Bo Richter and Tracy Kendall. And they basically help me talk to the animals that we're going to work with. My job is to come up with the ideas, the scientific ideas. I'll tell that to Tracy and to Bo and say, you make this fun for the animals that we're going to study, including KP2. And they have to design out sort of how to talk to the seal, how to train him, and to make the day-to-day research that we do fun. So, you know, even if you were training a dog, and every day you say, sit here for 10 minutes and wait, and then I'm going to feed you a whole lot after 10 minutes, or come over here and breathe here, or swim around in a circle, or hold your breath for, you know, 5 minutes. You know, the first time it seems sort of fun, but by you're doing the 10th time, it's like the dog's going to just say, forget it, I know the routine. And it's the same for a seal or a dolphin or a sea otter. These guys that I work with are absolutely the best, you know, and I feel aquariums are always trying to steal them away from me because they just know how to do what we call research training and get the animals to consider it all a game. So they're there, and then we supplement their capability with about 20 undergraduate students. So at any one time, there are anywhere between 5 and 10 students at the lab doing everything from learning how to be trainers to cleaning tanks to doing water quality and veterinary work and the rest of it. So it's a big team. Even if we only have one seal at a time, it can be, you know, pretty daunting, all the things that have to get done.
And why didn't he want to eat?
So we bring the seal to the lab, and he's been out in the wild eating and catching his own fish. And he doesn't want anything we're going to give him. We're giving him dead things. You know, he hated squid. Herring he would just sniff at, which is like the candy of fish to give a marine mammal. And we had two problems. One was what we were giving him was dead, so he had to figure out how to eat something that wasn't going to move. And then the other is that he only knew how to eat in water. So imagine if you're trying to train a dog, and you're going to give it a biscuit because it's done something good. You say, good dog, give it the biscuit, and it makes the connection between the good thing he did and the biscuit. This was not happening with KP2. At best, he would sniff at what we gave him, and he'd say no. Or he would take the fish, run back into the water, play with it for, you know, 15 minutes, and we were getting nowhere with the training. He had to be able to take fish out of the trainer's hand and make the connection between good boy and the fish. So this is something that Bo did. I found just amazing. I love the way these trainers think. So he goes, well, the problem is that the seal wants to eat in water. We want him out on the deck working with us. So he takes a dishpan of salt water, puts it between him and the seal, has the seal target on his hand. That was the command, just touch my hand. The seal does it. He goes, good boy. And he takes a fish and he just throws it into the pan of water. And the seal's looking at him. He's looking at the fish. He's like, oh, I don't. I'm in air, but the fish is in water. And finally, he makes a decision. He just dives into the pan of water, eats the fish, and then it all worked from there. It was just brilliant. And in the end, we had him eating literally out of our hands, and we're able to then do all the research training we needed.
How does the intelligence of a seal compare to the intelligence we always hear about regarding the dolphin?
You know, intelligence, it's so hard to try and measure that. But I found that working with KP2, he was almost like working with a really loyal dog. You know, I find them really pretty quick learners. And even KE18, here's a wild adult male that we have now. And despite that, they get it really fast. You can train them really quickly to come over, to keep their space, to show body parts for veterinary exams, blood sampling, and the rest of it. So I think there's a degree of confidence that we really like about these seals, because if they're afraid, they're not going to, you know, it's going to be hard. But they're confident and they're smart, and that makes them really easy to work with relative to some really stubborn animals.
I think there was reference in your book to a rogue Hawaiian monk seal that you might have worked with. Was that 18? Is that how you got 18, that he was out there doing bad things? And
There were a number of other seals that have this behavior where they might kill females. They might kill females.
Right, yeah, that's
males.
It.
And KE18 is one of those males. He was one of the more recent ones over the last year or so. And he was killing pups, and he was fighting with other monk seals. When you only have 1,100 of them left, you've got to do something when you've got an animal like this. So, again, it was a situation where National Marine Fisheries Service says the seal has got to be taken out of the population. But what do you do? Again, no place to put them in Hawaii, and you euthanize it or you find a home for it. And the water had not even settled in KP2's pool from the time we transferred him to Waikiki Aquarium. And they turned around and said, we have this adult male. Do you want to try and work with him? Because the only other option is to really euthanize him. So, again, we said yes. And this time, oh, my gosh, you know, we're bringing in something that's several hundred pounds. It's as big as any Weddell seal I worked with in the Antarctic. And I just said, what have I gotten us into this time? It was daunting. And he was covered in scars. He's got a massive shark bite wound on his chest. He's got bite wound scars all over his back from the fights he's been in. And he has turned out to be one of the best research animals we've ever had. He's just, like I said, he's confident, never showed us any aggression, and is learning all the same sort of research goals or reaching all the same research goals that we've had with KP2. So now we'll have a pup versus an adult. So now we're getting somewhere with the science.
You're listening to Terry Williams, author of The Odyssey of KP2, An Orphan Seal, A Marine Biologist, and The Fight to Save a Species. The book is this year's campus read at Boise State, and Dr. Williams will be visiting our campus Tuesday, March 3rd, to present a public lecture.
Well, now, KP2 came into your lab with these cataracts you mentioned earlier. How do you care for a seal's eyes? And by the way, what impressed me the most about this subject was the way your trainers were able to get this guy into a position so you could actually do something about it. You might want to explain that.
In terms of him stationing?
Yeah, I mean, this is a wild animal. And he was more docile than I'd be in a chair having somebody look at my eyes.
It's sort of funny, isn't it? It's like I'm so used to, they just sit there for all this stuff, but it's like I wouldn't do it. It's like,
right.
It was amazing. He learned, and you remember, this is like dealing with a two-year-old kid. You know, he wants to play around, and you're like, nope, you have got to sit completely still. We didn't want to sedate him. It's really hard to sedate a marine mammal. They go into dive response, and it can be really scary. So instead, we tried to just use training to get him to sit very still, and it was amazing. He would put his chin on a little chin rest, then these doctors would come in and poke his eyes and do ultrasounds and everything else. I would never stand for it, and yet the seal would just, lie there, look up, allow it to happen, and then you give him a handful of fish, and he was happy.
That's
so
great.
So we monitored his eyes very, very closely to look at the progression of the cataracts, and each day he had to have a salve, so some ointment that was put into his eyes. And he was very, very good about all of it, which, like I said, I wouldn't do it. My dog wouldn't do it.
Well, aside from all the laughter and the tears and the great story of humanity that's told about this wild animal, there's the research. That's really what brought him to your lab. And I don't think we have time to go through all of the components of your research, but the one that I remember that I thought was really fascinating was your studying the seal's ability to dive deeper and what happens to the seal's metabolism in the process. And the reason I guess why that's important is because on those islands where fish are being hunted by man and seal, there may be fewer of them, and seals are driven down deeper. They're driven out farther, and perhaps that's contributing to their demise. I know I'm oversimplifying this, but I wonder if you could help us understand what, by the time it was all over, by the time he goes back to the islands, you've had 2 years to work with him, what were you able to discover that may play some role in extending the life of this endangered species?
Sure. So one of the biggest issues, as you can imagine, in Hawaii is which beach gets to be a human beach, which beach should be a seal beach. And they may not be mutually exclusive, but everybody's going to be hunting for fish. One of the things that National Marine Fisheries Service is trying to do is to designate what's the critical habitat. Where are the places that the seals have to be? The problem is that you could select all the beaches. You could say, sure, they could find fish everywhere. You could say maybe we should only have deep water areas for seals. Maybe that's a good place for them. They won't be as close to humans. But what you needed was an understanding of the basic biology to tell you what is easy and what is hard for a seal. Instead of saying, let's give the seals what's left over from the humans, what if you looked at it and said, what do seals need? What are they built to do? And that's how we do all of our science. All of it is simply to say, I don't care what's really out there in the environment. I want to first know what these animals basically are built to do. How deep can they dive? How long do they hold their breath? What water temperatures do they need? And that's what we did with KP2. We put a profile together that said, here are the water temperatures that are the easiest for this seal to live in. And as you can imagine, that profile is really different for a tropical seal than it is for our harbor seals along our own coast here or the Antarctic seals. They have a really narrow window of water temperatures that are comfortable. Any colder and they start shivering. And then the question came up, how deep should these animals dive? They're seeing from time depth recorders, instruments that they put on some of the wild monk seals, that they were going to over 500 meters, which didn't make sense. It was not consistent with what their eyes were telling me, you know, in terms of what I thought they could see underwater. So we started looking at just how long can a monk seal hold its breath. And those were some of the tests with KP2, and we measured metabolism and everything that went with it, and developed sort of a three-dimensional profile of where monk seals biologically are suited to live and to find fish versus areas they can go to, but will be really, really hard and in the end probably be sort of diminishing returns. You've expended so much energy to get to your fish that it really doesn't count when you finally eat it. It'd be like you driving in circles to get to the gas station. So you drive around and drive around, drive around to get to your gas station, but you've wasted so much gas to get there that, you know, sooner or later, it's just not going to work out. So that was what we were doing with him. And I think that it's helping with the mapping of Hawaii and just telling one scientist where these animals should live and where the critical habitats should be, and then also to help inform local people and say, these areas are absolutely what these animals are suited to live in, and the other areas that you think they might go to because they won't conflict with your operations may not be quite as good. And then the question becomes, how do you live together? How do you share those resources? And that's a bigger social issue than the scientist can address just yet.
That's right. And, of course, that's a mainland issue as well. You know, these seals go back 12 to 14 million years. And in your book, at one point, you trace the way the Hawaiian monk seal probably found its way all the way from the coast of Turkey and Greece, where the first species may have started up, and I'm probably oversimplifying this, but you have to wonder, the Caribbean monk seal, a cousin of this Hawaiian monk seal, has gone extinct. I think it was officially declared in 2008. Does climate change have anything to do with this? Are the waters these seals are traveling in changing to any extent that makes it more difficult for them to survive in 2013 as opposed to a few million years ago?
I think that the effects of climate change are going to be felt on the seals' prey. So what we're seeing in, say, harbor seals, where they can move up and down coasts and we can watch where they're going, they're following where their prey are going. And you're watching them move further and further north or south, depending on where they live. So there is an effect that's being seen. The issue for the Hawaiian monk seal is that there's nowhere to go. Mm-hmm. They are in an isolated island thousands of miles from anywhere else, and they're not going to be able to make that transect that once happened when land masses were much closer to each other and the oceans were a heck of a lot warmer. You've got the Mediterranean monk seal that is teetering so close to the edge of extinction. Yeah, they're I hate to say this, circling the drain right now. I just don't know if they're going to be able to pull out of that one. I hope the conservation efforts will do that for them. But that one is at extreme risk. Hawaiian monk seal is following behind, and with 1,100, one of the reasons I wanted to work with them is just that I thought they had a chance, that with that many animals, you have enough diversity there in terms of their genetics that if you can just get them on an upward trajectory, you just might save the species. So all of it is factoring in. And I just, when it comes to the Hawaiian monk seal, I just feel like there are so few options. You either learn to live with humans in the islands, or that's it, because there's nowhere else to swim.
And, of course, the number of humans has increased dramatically in the Hawaiian Islands, and I assume along with it, fishing and some of the impacts that you've described earlier, the nets and whatever, there's more of those than there probably were a couple of hundred years ago. You add all that up, and, well, you've told the story.
Yeah, and I really think that we have to have a change in the way that we deal with endangered species. And it's not just the Hawaiian monk seal. This is just the one that we have a high-profile story for. But you could take in your favorite endangered species, whatever it may be, panda bears. People are thinking polar bears are becoming endangered. And we're going to have to start looking at our world through their eyes. What is it that they need? And then how do we start to figure out how we're both going to survive on this planet? And the whole way in which we fund trying to save these species, it becomes a depressing story for even people that want to enter into biology. It's like, well, there's just no hope. There's no grants. We can't do this. And I'm going to be working very hard over the next few years to get the way in which we support the science of saving endangered species changed around. We have to, because if we don't, if we follow the trajectory that we're on, it's true. We're all going to go extinct because the animals will go first and humans are going to follow second. So I feel very strongly about that.
I'm interviewing Terry Williams. The Odyssey of KP2 is the name of the book, An Orphan Seal, A Marine Biologist, and The Fight to Save a Species. Those of us here at Boise State who are supporting faculty doing research, we're particularly concerned about the impact of the federal budget on the National Science Foundation and the National Institute of Health. What sources in Washington do you look to for funding your research?
Oh, my gosh, I don't want to depress your audience. I once gave a lecture on this, and people were so depressed. Yeah. But here's, I'll tell you the situation. You can decide if you want to tell folks. But for doing work on animals, most biologists go to National Science Foundation. That's where the biology of animals are studied, at least the organization. They're now funding all grants for all biology at a level of about 4%. So 4% of the grant proposals going in might get funded. When you put big animal research, and especially endangered animal research, against all the other things, the genetics and the, other organisms and the easier things to study, the insects, the mice, the small things, there is very, very little that's ever been funded at an organismal level, and not for endangered species work. So it's specifically, they want what they call transformative science, which is transformative in a big conceptual way. And I understand it, but I can tell you I've never gotten an NSF grant for doing the physiology of any of the animals I studied. It just doesn't work. So that's out. NIH is out. They used to have a comparative program, but they stopped that one. That's gone. For federal agencies, you already know that these wildlife agencies are hurting. Their mandate is to do population counting. They have to at least get that done. So the first thing that disappears is the basic research. So then that's out. You're now into aquariums and zoos, zoological societies and such. They get their money, and I've talked to Smithsonian and all. They get a minimum amount from the government. Then you've got foundations, so wildlife foundations, World Wildlife Fund, and that kind of thing, that help to fund programs in coordination with these zoos. So they're going to the foundations. A person like me could try to go to some of these foundations, and we have, but the level of funding, as you can imagine, is based on donations from people. And again, if you've got to at least find out where the animals are, a lot of the research is a hands-off kind of research where you're monitoring from afar. So again, you miss out on what is it that makes a dolphin, a seal, a mountain lion. So that it's pretty, you know, if I wasn't such an optimist, I would be
depressed. I hear you.
Right. I know. But that's what I mean about having to change how we do this. So my fight is going to be, we've got to decide, do we want these animals? And if we do, then how are we going to fund the scientists and the next generation of kids? How do we get them? Because they're all enthusiastic. I love teaching at the university because at that level, everyone's like, wahoo, you know, let's save the world. We're going to change it. And we're going to save these species. I still believe that we can do that, but it's going to take a radical change in the way in which we fund that. And I don't know, do you put a 1 cent tax on any resource that we take? You know, do you say if you're going to have a ship or a tanker or something come through your area, you tax those entities going through oceans that could affect animals? Do you pay up front for, you know, a deep horizon spill, knowing that it will probably happen, and say, well, if you're going to be in this area, then you've got to pay for the dolphins and everything that live in that area? I don't have the answer for all of that, but I believe there's some really smart people in economics that could probably figure it out.
Well, it certainly sounds like you're on the right track, and I do want to remind our listeners that for those interested in personally supporting Terry's work in her lab, at the end of the book, Additional Reading and Resources, there's a website, www.monkseal.ucsc.edu. There's any number of ways to get to Terry's website, but Terry, that is another avenue that I know isn't as lucrative, but I know you accept contributions from people who are interested in furthering your work.
We can always take another fish.
That's right.
But here's something really positive that people can do. So we talked about fishermen and fishing lines and such, and bills that have been introduced to use more natural kinds of you know, materials in these lines. And it failed because in the Senate, it failed because, you know, a number of fishermen said, no, this is not, we don't want to do this. And therefore they said, well, we're not going to introduce this. There's too much resistance. But no one ever talks to their politicians about the simple fact that they want these animals. Yeah, so just a simple letter, and not a mass email, not a petition, but an individual letter to your own people that are in the government and just say, I like these animals, and I don't care if it's the monk seal in Hawaii or if it's a local animal, but they need to hear that, and that will make a difference.
Well, we have run out of time, but Terry, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to be on the show, to do two segments of this for us, for writing the book. Thank you so much for being on Reader's Corner.
Thank you again.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Terry Williams. She will present a lecture open to the public at 6 p.m. on Tuesday, March 3rd in the Simplot Ballroom in the Student Union Building. Find out more at boisestate.edu. Next week, Clive Thompson, author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.